Tina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand. Two masters of the trade, conversation hot, you need a fan. It's Legal Face Off, so step into the ring. No topic off limit, cause they gon' cover everything. Now check them out on Facebook and Twitter. Like and follow because we don't wanna miss ya. Introducing your host, Christina and Rich.
Legal Face Off. It is the final episode of February. Legal Face Off on WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. Only one of the Legal Eagles is here. Tina Martini out sick. She will be fine. She'll be back before you know it. Rich Lenkoff in the house. My name is Sam Paniatovich and Craig Collins across the glass. Plenty to get to on LFO per usual. We'll talk about balancing work as a lawyer and an NCAA referee, time in the Obama White House, celebrity divorces, plus the legal grab bag. But we start with the son of an 85 Bear, Treg Durson, talking about the Durson Act.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Treg, talk to us about how you came to this issue, you know, your relationship with your dad, Dave Durson, and then how you came to be involved in this very important issue.
Yeah, well, 7 years ago, my father tragically took his own life. And before taking his own life, he also simultaneously donated his brain to science. And we followed through with that donation. And as a result of giving it to Boston University, we had the result that came out that he did have chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, which is a disease called by repetitive head trauma. Now, in 2011, that's not that long ago, but back then, there wasn't that much awareness around concussions or CTE and how sports should change. So my family and I were really put in a position where we had a lot of contacts to the world's top neurologists and advocates, and we really wanted to be a part of helping youth sports and protecting young athletes. And that really put us on the front lines. In 2012, we helped with a concussion donation to all Chicago public schools that play football. In 2015, we got behind a bill that requires kids to see a medical professional before returning to play after they do have a concussion. And currently I sit on Illinois High School Sports Association Sports Advisory Board, advising them on how to make sports safer for all children in Illinois. So this is a passionate issue for us, and we're evolving with the game and evolving with science.
So that brings us to the Dave Durson Act. Tell us about that and the current status of this legislation.
Yeah, the way that this act got introduced was part of some new studies that have been coming out over the past few months and year. And what these studies are, we're seeing research that's showing that the more subconcussive hits young athletes take, the more likely it is that they could develop a neurological disease like CTE. So it's similar to smoking. If you have exposure to smoking for a long time, the more likely it is for you to have cancer. So with these studies coming out, we really wanted to introduce a bill to protect young athletes, particularly during the key stages of their life when their brains are developing. You know, from 6 to 12, there's a key developmental stage that all children's brains go through. And it's important that we give them the time to develop and not be exposed to subconcussive hits or full-blown concussions. And currently, the bill is... We introduced the bill. We actually have it in Mental Health Committee, and the Mental Health Committee date is March 1st. And the goal is to have, we need the majority of the committee members on mental health to agree with us. And then once they do, we can put it on the House floor for a vote.
So there's been pushback. A spokesman for Pop Warner said that literally millions of young people have played Pop Warner football for 90 years and have grown up to be healthy, successful adults, contributing to society in so many ways. He went on to say that the life lessons, experiences, and memories of playing tackle football far outweigh the risks. What's your response to that?
Well, my response is we're not taking away the game of football. And the lessons that children can learn by playing flag football can still be taught. You know, when I played football, my father and I talked about the preparation of the game, the strategy that it takes, the experience of coming together with your peers to overcome obstacles and win a game. So all of the beautiful values and lessons of football can still be taught in a game that does not require children to be hit in the head. Now, as far as Pop Warner saying, you know, millions of their former athletes go on to be successful people, I don't know anything about that study. I certainly hope that's the case, but you know, we're basing this act based on data and compelling science that is coming from neurologists, particularly Boston University.
You know, people underestimate how great flag football is. The Pro Bowl, for example, everyone's so afraid of injury that there's been a lot of talk about converting that into a flag football game for professionals. And that would be amazing, in my opinion, to watch. And I think maybe it would make kids a little bit more excited to play something where you don't have to be in danger of being traumatically injured.
I would love to see that. And, you know, I think it would be great if the NFL led the effort to really promote flag football for young athletes, and there's no better way to do it than the Pro Bowl, in my opinion.
Yeah, we've covered this issue extensively in our show. We've had a lot of former athletes on. I played football, tackle football, my whole life. I mean, from elementary school through high school. But I've got a 8-year-old boy now. I won't let him play tackle football. He's playing flag football now for the first time. Loves it. But I can't see me allowing him. And he's a great athlete. He's actually a great quarterback. But I couldn't allow him to play. Trey, your dad was a hero, on the field, of course, incredible football player, key member of the greatest team in football history, the 85 Bears. But what he did in the wake of the tragedy was, I think, a bigger contribution that he could make to not just football, but to society. So he's a real hero of mine, of ours, and we really appreciate all the work you're doing on this issue.
Thank you. I really appreciate you saying that. And, we're really just trying to continue on with his last wishes. And I think the action of him donating his brain for the benefit of science and for football is really important. And we've got to ensure that we protect young athletes and also protect the future of the game.
Well, thank you once again for joining us, Trey. We'll talk to you again soon.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated, and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN at WGNradio.com. Tina Martini fighting the injury bug, but Rich Lenkoff is here, and we roll right along. Joining us on the phones now, Jack Tice, who's a partner at Riley Safer Homes in Cancilla, and he spent 2 years in the Obama White House. Jack, welcome to Legal Face-Off.
Well, great to be here.
Jack, in your former role at the White House, you were dealing with crisis management every day. As lawyers, we also deal with that in a different way. How do you contrast what you're doing today versus what you were doing in the White House?
Sure. So I think in terms of skills, they're pretty similar. When I was in the White House, there were investigations would happen, or they would get a phone call with someone saying, we have an issue that's emerging. How do we deal with it? And, the approach that I would take in the White House would be, all right, let's get to the core facts. Let's find out what happened, what the risk is, what's the exposure, how do we handle it, how do we talk about it publicly. Those same kind of skills happen to individuals and companies all the time, and so I think that kind of translates directly over. There also were, part of the work that I did in the counsel's office was with investigations, so congressional investigations, dealing with someone across the table saying, we want this information and we want to talk to these people and those sort of things. That same kind of working with clients now in private practice to say, here's how we're going to prep for this, and here are the questions you're likely going to get, here are the issues you're going to look at, always, you have the truth on your side, and that's going to guide you through it. That kind of counseling is what I'm doing now, and I think it's great to have those kind of skills translate over.
I imagine working as special assistant and associate counsel to, probably the most important client in the world, which is the President of the United States, makes you really focus on presenting materials, presenting information to your boss, in this case, President Obama, in a really efficient manner. You know, I imagine that President Obama, like any president, but especially, you know, based on what we've seen of him, really is someone who doesn't have a lot of time and probably not a lot of patience to wade through unnecessary information. How important was it to present to the council and to President Obama information in a way that was, you know, quickly and easily digestible?
Absolutely. That's incredibly important. I think you want to make sure that you, in any sort of, especially in sort of a written memos or in an oral presentation that you're giving in a meeting, it was drilled into us from the very beginning that include all of the important information and really think hard about what that important information needs to be and absolutely present it in a concise and digestible way. The decisions, that there is so much paper that goes through the White House in a variety of different ways. There's an entire office that's dedicated just to managing the paper flow that goes to the president, and separate from that, in the White House staff, there's just a constant stream of emails and information, and sort of multiply that with like Twitter and other things from the outside, and there's just a constant, you know, you want to make sure that you're boiling things down, condensing them, and making them exceptionally clear. And that exact kind of, you know, again, that's a skill, and that's something that I've taken from the White House and brought into the private practice as well.
Jack, we've covered on the show whether the president, whether the current president, President Trump, can and will pardon people like Paul Manafort, others who, Michael Flynn, who have been indicted. Is pardon something that you dealt with in the in your role in the White House? And if so, do you have any thoughts on that process?
Yeah, so certainly in the White House counsel's office, there's a variety of the White House counsel, whoever he or she is, can set up their teams in a variety of different ways. When I was there, there were teams that worked on policy. The team that I was on called Oversight, which had investigations and other components to it. There was a vetting team, an ethics team, and then there was a whole team that was devoted just to commutations and pardons. And they worked really hard and in close coordination with the Department of Justice pardon attorney to work through all of the different appeals for pardons and the different commutations of sentences over the course of the administration. It's one of the broadest powers the president has, and so President Obama was very careful to do it only to use it very carefully because of how broad it was. There was really not a ton of review from any other branch for that kind of power. Bring it back to the current days. You know, I don't have any sort of insights into that, but certainly because it's such a broad power, presumably the Department of Justice being very careful to consider how its investigation and how any indictments that come out of it will relate back to that power and could be undone by that power. So that means thinking about the pardon power only applies to federal crimes and actions. So does that mean that the state crimes and actions, if there are any, if those can be preserved? Another thing that I just to add on to that too is to think about what a pardon would mean for a congressional investigation, which is something that sort of, you know, there are congressional investigations that are going on, and many people have pled the fifth and said that I can't testify in front of you, Congress, because I'm invoking my Fifth Amendment rights. There's an interesting question of if someone's pardoned, does that mean that they can no longer have that protection of the Fifth Amendment because there's no fear of prosecution or any sort of criminal repercussions? So there might in some ways be a problem if someone's pardoned, exactly what you said, if General Flynn or others would be pardoned, you know, could they be called up to Congress the following day and say, well, now we want to know everything that you know? So in any event, it's certainly, I've read public reports too, no inside information about this, but public reports that the White House Counsel's Office is looking very careful at this power, and that makes a ton of sense for them to do that because it's going to be a key piece of this investigation as it goes on.
Jack, last question. You are a Chicago guy. You went to Pritzker School of Law at Northwestern. The Obama administration had visits from several Chicago championship teams.
That's right.
I was lucky enough to be at the White House for the Blackhawks' third visit. It was unbelievable. You were there for at least a couple. What was the most exciting moment from any of the times that you spent with the teams that were visiting Chicago? I think you were probably there for, what, Blackhawks third and Cubs?
Yep,
and Cubs?
Exactly. Yeah, I sat in the back corner for the Blackhawks third, but I have to, you know, as a lifelong Cub fan growing up right near Wrigley Field, one of the greatest moments of my life was the day the Cubs came to the White House. Just sort of, it was, you know, just mind-blowing to be in the same room as, you know, President Obama, you know, Rizzo, Javi, and Bryant, and the rest of the Cubs. And then to sit next to my childhood hero, Ryan Sandberg, you know, I tell my wife, it's like, number one is the day that we got married. Number two, it's the day our two kids are born. And right pretty close to that in terms of days that are pretty incredible in my life is that day with the Cubs. So that was a really, really great day.
Great stuff. That's Jack Tice. He's a partner at Riley Safer Homes in Cancilla. We appreciate your stay on Legal Face Off.
Thank you, guys. Thank you both.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face Off. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina is chair of DLA Piper's Intellectual Property Practice Group in Chicago, and she serves as the firm's national hiring partner for associate recruiting. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell, and selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is a columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host. She frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. DLA Piper is a global law firm with lawyers located in more than 40 countries throughout the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia Pacific. DLA Piper is positioned to help its clients with their legal needs around the world. To learn more about DLA Piper, please contact Tina or visit dlapiper.com.
Joining us on the phones now, a partner at Wasser, Cooperman & Mandels. She's an attorney. She's also an author. It Doesn't Have to Be That Way was the book, which was 5 years ago, and the website, it's overeasy.com. Joining us on Legal Face-Off, hello, Laura Wasser.
Hello, Rich and Sam.
Laura, you're one of the top family law attorneys in the country, very preeminent, been practicing for many years. You came up with this idea, which seems like it, you know, it's only a matter of time. It's an amazing idea. It's overeasy.com. Tell us about it and what prompted you to start this company.
Well, I've been practicing family law for 23 plus years here in Southern California, and simply because of the length of time I've been doing it, it became apparent to me that there is a whole slew of people out there that can't afford the kind of fees we charge at our firm and don't really need to. There are plenty of divorces where both people are on the same page, and so this is kind of the do-it-yourself version. People are shopping online, banking online, dating online. Why not give them the opportunity to go through their legal and financial part of their divorce online as well?
So divorce is, as you mentioned, typically very protracted, very hostile, very litigious, right? It's surprising, I'm sure, for many people who hear about your service that someone who represents clients on an hourly basis would come up with a way to, you know, sort of cut through a lot of that. You know, do you face a lot of resistance from people who think, why would someone who's in the business of representing people in divorce come up with a way to do it cheaper and more easy?
Not so much. I think most of my colleagues are on the same page as I with regard to being problem solvers, wanting to get through it, and really wanting to change the face of divorce. We've seen such change even in the past 20 years in terms of how we look at custody and having dads being much more hands-on, in terms of who's the breadwinner, in terms of how we do things. And I feel like our society is so much more mediation-oriented that if we can help people get through the process, there will always be complex litigation cases, always. There will be enough work for all of us, but what we really do strive for, at least the people that I work with here in California and the folks in New York that have worked with me on the site, is trying to get people to a place where if they are getting divorced, they can do it in a much more amicable and cost-effective way.
So, Laura, the average divorce in the U.S. costs about $20,000. Your easy package costs $750 per spouse. What are you getting for that entry-level package at itsovereasy.com?
The 750 gets you the forms and our artificial intelligence that we've kind of gone through and baked into the platform to help you fill those forms out in a way that no other kind of online divorce site has been able to do. It also gets you a ton of content. Actually, you can get the content without even paying the 750. If your listeners come on and check us out at itsovereasy.com, we've got blogs and interviews and profiles of people who have been through it, who have been professionals in the world of divorce and breakups and post-divorce. And then we also have a fantastic provider directory of people in your area that can help with everything from figuring out where to move, figuring out how to get medical insurance if you're no longer covered by your spouse's company, to figuring out how to get your teeth whitened or a spray tan so you can get out there and start dating again. Full mind and body, emotional and financial wellness referral source that we've kind of curated and made available to people. But the 750 package has that, whereas our 1500 package and our 2500 package includes either 30 or 90 minutes respectively with a divorce coach, kind of mediator, not someone who will represent you or advocate for you or even give you advice on the law, but will explain what the law is so that you can use that knowledge and education to apply it to your own situation.
Laura, you've, as you mentioned, been practicing family law in California for 23 years. Your clients have included the likes of Ryan Reynolds, Heidi Klum, Ashton Kutcher, Johnny Depp, just to mention a few. Why is marriage so difficult under the spotlight? Or do you feel like Hollywood marriages are no different than the average American marriage in that, you know, so many of them do end up in separation or divorce?
The latter. I feel like they're, you know, one of those magazines has a section that says, like, stars, they're just like us. I think we read and see a lot more about the celebrity divorces and breakups, but I don't think they're any more difficult. I think that, you know, it's the more money, more problems type of thing, but again, money will sometimes help you get through difficult situations. I feel like my celebrity and high profile and high net worth clients go through the same frustrations and pain and anger and sadness and the being scared of the unknown that us regular people have when we have a breakup. You just read about it more because they're famous, because they are under the spotlight.
That is Laura Wasser, partner at Wasser, Cooperman & Mandels, a divorce attorney out on the West Coast. Thank you for joining us here in Chicago, Laura.
Thank you very much for having me. Please come visit us on itsovereasy.com.
Our final guest on Legal Face-Off here before the grab bag, he is a senior partner of Capron and Avgerinos. Dan Capron joining us on LFO. Welcome, Dan.
I'm happy to be here.
Not just a senior partner, but a Big Ten official. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
We've tried to have you on a couple times. You've been busy, though, but we wanted to talk to you about your work not just as an attorney. You and I have tangled on many cases, being on opposite sides, but you're also a referee in the Big Ten, and in fact, you worked the national championship game in which Alabama beat Georgia.
So I did.
First question is, how do you juggle both the demands of a busy lawyer, and I know you're one of the busiest ones around, and also working as an official in one of the foremost conferences in college football?
Well, it requires a great deal of patience and understanding of opposing counsels like yourself, as well as the hearing officers who hear my cases, but fortunately, word has tended to get around that this is what I do on the weekends in the fall, and most people are pretty understanding about it. So it's not been all that difficult to juxtapose the two vocations.
So this is kind of a cliched question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How does working as an official help you in your work as a personal injury lawyer and vice versa?
I would just say that of the two, being an official is more difficult, and I could sum it up in a couple of different ways. There are almost 100,000 lawyers in the state of Illinois. There are 66 officials on the entire Big Ten staff, and that's a staff that extends from Nebraska all the way to New Jersey. Secondly, we get one look at the play at full speed. When you're in court, by contrast, I've yet to encounter a judge that won't allow you time to go look things up. So it's a little bit more challenging to be an official, but, you know, that's just my take on it.
How does that process begin, Dan? How do you go from law to doing the referees? How do you get going in there? And then how does that path work out as you climb up and up?
You know, I interestingly, and this is just purely coincidence, I started practicing law the same year that I started officiating. It was 1981. Wow. And in law, I mean, once you're a lawyer, you're a lawyer. I mean, and they throw you on whatever case it is that they throw you on. But in officiating, you start out truly at the lowest levels. And when I say that, I mean below high school. We're talking about fifth and sixth grade little kids that are out there running around. They can't even run fast enough to really hurt each other. And then after doing that, then eventually you move up to freshman high school, sophomore ball, JV ball, varsity ball, small college. And then if you're fortunate enough, if you're good enough, and if you keep at it, and if you have people that can speak for you, you can make it to Division I football. And I was very fortunate to have that happen.
Dan, so I've seen you on many a Saturday officiating games when I'm flipping around on TV. But lo and behold, there it was, January 8th evening, yep. turning yep. on the national championship game. Yep. And who do I see as the lead official but Dan Capron? Tell us how you got that assignment. Obviously, it's a reward for years and years of excellent work as an official. But how does that process work? How much lead time do you have? And how does a Big Ten crew get selected? Because I know the whole crew is Big Ten, correct?
It is, and that's an excellent question. Back in the first week of December, when they announced the pairings for the Final Four, immediately that disqualifies any officials from the staff of any of the teams, any of the conferences that are in the Final Four. This year, of course, that meant SEC officials were out, Big 12 officials were out, and ACC officials were out, leaving only the Pac-12 and the Big Ten. I say only because if you're not a member of the Power Five conferences, you're not eligible to work the national championship. They're not going to have somebody from the MAC or the Sun Belt Conference or something like that. So then when it was just the Big Ten and the Pac-12 that was left, they looked at who had had that game more recently. So this is where a little bit of luck comes involved. And the Pac-12 has had it more recently than the Big Ten. So the Big Ten at that point was going to get the national championship. What the Big Ten does, that kicks it up to my boss, who's the Big Ten supervisor. He then looks at the people at each position and who has rated out first at each position. But if you don't have major bowl experience, that disqualifies you right there. You have to have worked either the Orange Bowl, the Sugar Bowl, the Fiesta Bowl, the Rose Bowl. They don't want the national championship to be your first time on the big stage. Out of eight referees in the Big Ten, that eliminated four of them right there. My personal position is referee, so I was competing against the other seven referees in the league. Well, that brought it down to one out of a four chance, and my boss apparently thought that I had had a better year or a good enough year, and I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time.
You make your own luck, Dan. You know you make your own luck. I do have a question, though. This is more of an issue at the NFL than it is in college. What the hell is a catch now? How do you define what a catch is in football?
You know, our rule is not all that different from theirs, other than the fact that we only have to have 1 foot down in bounds and they have to have two. But as I understand, and I don't know the NFL rules all that well, I don't profess to, but if I understand what they're trying to do, if you're in the act of going to the ground when you're attempting to make a catch, you've got to survive the ground. The analogy would be a catcher at home plate. If you've got the ball and here comes the base runner and there's a collision, if I'm the umpire, show me the ball. You've got to survive that collision. All right? So if you can survive the ground and maintain possession of the ball throughout the process of hitting the ground, that's a catch, as long as you get a body part down in bounds.
So, Dan, I've always wanted to ask an official this question. You were involved in one of the great college football games of all time, certainly one of the great endings of all time. For our listeners who don't remember, the national championship game, Alabama was down 20-7 in the third quarter. They rallied to tie the game. It was back and forth. Then in overtime, on what, a 2nd and 26, I think it was, the quarterback who came in at halftime, I'm going to butcher his name, Tua Tagovailoa. However you pronounce it.
Call him Tua.
What'd you say, Sam? Yeah, you got it. Tua looked off a free safety and perfectly placed ball in the hands of Devonta Smith for the game-winning 41-yard touchdown. My question to you is, you know, you're officiating this game. You've got to, you know, have a laser-like focus on what you're doing. But at some point, do you ever sort of have a little piece in your brain saying, oh, my God, I can't believe what I just saw? Or do you save that till later?
I didn't see it because I'm doing my job, And my job is to protect the quarterback, make sure that he's not roughed or fouled in any way. Also, I have some duties on offensive holding, hands to the face, some of the interior line play, chop blocks, things like that. So I'm looking where I'm supposed to be looking. Now, what I get, I see the ball gone, but I'm not looking downfield. I'm still looking at my quarterback, and then I hear the crowd reaction. So I know that something huge has just happened, but I don't know what it is yet. It might have been an interception. It might have been a touchdown. And then by the time I look up, now all of a sudden Alabama is celebrating, and I ascertain, oh, my gosh, we've got a touchdown. I want to hesitate for just a second to make sure that instant replay isn't buzzing us, trying to contact the crew on the field to review the play to make sure that, in fact, it was a catch. But once we got 5-10 seconds went by with no buzz from the replay booth, game over. We're running off the field.
So your eyes are on the quarterback. You didn't see the final play maybe until you saw it on the video board, but you did see Tua scramble on that third down, but third and about 15 at midfield when somehow he broke like three tackles, got the first down. This kid coming in, can you believe the moxie for a freshman to come in off the bench in the national title game? That was incredible.
Yeah, he showed a lot of poise, and the only thing that I really noted was that he was lefty, so, you know, we went from a right-handed quarterback to a left-handed quarterback, and, you know, I'm making mental notes on that. If he rolls out, he's likely to roll out away from me, which gives me backside responsibility, but I don't want to get too inside baseball here. Those are kind of arcane mechanical duties of the officials on the field. It raises the larger point that we're not watching this game in the same way that you are. We're not watching it Absolutely. As fans. It's very clinical, and we break it down into our component parts and the things that we're responsible for, and you use the term laser-like focus. That's really what we have to have.
Last question. We'll let you go, Dad. I mean, this is fascinating. We could talk all day, but last question. You know, in the wake of the game, certainly your, you know, any official has to deal with criticism, especially on the scale of the game that you called, especially in the ending being way in the way that it ended. Do you look at Twitter? Do you look at, you know, people criticizing you and your crew? And also, how do you deal with criticism in your professional life? And do those two things correlate at all? And we'll let you go after this question.
I can't even remember getting criticism in my professional life as an attorney. I mean, it doesn't really happen. Certainly nowhere near the context of what we get on the football field. I can only say this. We don't pay any attention to what the fans have to say because fans are fans, and the word fan is short for fanatic. So we're not really interested in that. We want to make sure that we call a perfect game. We rarely attain that level of perfection. But as far as I'm concerned about what my boss thinks, the supervisor of officials. I'm concerned about what my peers think, the other referees in the Big Ten and the other Power Five conferences who I know as well. And I want to make sure that I can put on a product that I can be proud of because I know that I've done the best job that I can in the eyes of the people who understand how the game is supposed to be officiated. I would even include to a certain extent the coaches because Coach Saban obviously has been around the block a few times. Kirby Smith has been at Georgia for fewer years, but he's no stranger to the game either. Both of those coaches were terrific during the game. There was very little complaining. They were just interested in coaching their teams, and it was an absolute pleasure to work for those gentlemen.
Dan Capron is a senior partner of Capron and Avgerinos and a founder of the firm. He also called the NCAA championship game. He refereed Alabama and Georgia. Thank you, Dan, for your time.
You're very welcome.
Seven topics on the Legal Grab Bag today. Legal Face-Off on WGN, WGN Radio.
Seven, but all one, just one person.
Yeah, all you, Rich. Seven up. Heads up.
Who's the cagey veteran in the Legal Grab Bag pen? Do we have anyone warming up for Tina? No
Whiteside
Jason
is not
Whiteside.
Here.
Kristen Decker, Brian Watercott. I don't think any of them are coming anytime soon. Let's just start with the first topic. The Missouri governor. What do you got?
Yeah, just when you thought Illinois was the only state with governors in hot water, late last week, the Missouri governor, Eric Reitens, who is a rising star in Republican politics, actually. He's a former veteran and you know, young guy. He was arrested and taken into custody by a Democratic prosecutor, St. Louis Circuit County, Kim Gardner, for felonious... what was it called? It was using, it was basically the allegation is that he was taking a photo of his the woman he was allegedly having an affair with, which is a misdemeanor, but it became a felony in this case because he transmitted it in a way that allows access to a computer. Basically, the allegation is that he was trying to blackmail his former mistress by taking a partially nude photo of her without her knowledge and without her consent. That's according to press services. He came out and denied what he called a reckless liberal prosecution. He said that he will be found innocent. He said he's looking forward to his legal remedies. Again, he has acknowledged in the past that he had an affair. This has been going on for a while. He's been in controversy for about 6 months over this. But just, again, last week we saw him actually arrested for taking this picture.
New charges have been unsealed against Paul Manafort, President Donald Trump's former campaign chairman.
Yeah, I mean, the Manafort saga continues under Bob Mueller. Late last week, there were new charges unsealed. There was a bail offer that was rejected. We saw Rick Gates, who was Trump's campaign deputy, plead guilty. So, you know, this is all gathering towards what lots of us feel is additional people involved. The aggressiveness with which Bob Mueller is going after these, you know, people like Michael Flynn and Gates and Manafort lead most to believe that there's, you know, additional evidence that will be uncovered, evidence of some collusion between the Trump administration and Russia. Now, obviously, Trump has vociferously denied that as recently as today. He's come on and said that that wasn't, that there's no collusion. Over the weekend, he called in to a Fox News show and said there was no collusion. He said that over and over again. The real question is to what extent Mueller will be squeezing these individuals with these indictments to find out what they knew about collusion and Russian meetings. Gates in particular and Manafort were in the room for at least one of these meetings that we know about. So, you know, Mueller is taking his time. He's being very deliberate. But these additional indictments certainly don't bode well for the administration.
On a show with two lawyers, we talk about the future of law all the time, and this is a recent study. CNBC reports, Rich, only 23% of recent law grads think their education was worth the cost. 23%. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, the high cost of legal education results in, you know, that kind of result. You know, it's so expensive to go to law school. People are leaving not just undergraduate school, but law school with, you know, mountains and mountains of debt, and there is not a great market out there for their services, even though now the legal economy has rebounded somewhat. You know, a couple of years ago, it was a lot tougher to get a job. Now it is a little easier, but there's still way too many lawyers hitting the market every year, just not enough jobs. So, yeah, this one study found that only 23% of law school graduates felt that their education was worth it. And those are people who are hitting the market and not finding jobs that are paying the debt that they accumulated in law school.
Just for comparison, 64% of recent doctoral degrees, they say it's worth it. 64% there. 58% of medical degrees, they say it's worth it. Only 23% of recent law grads say it was worth the cost. So there you have it.
We here at Legal Face-Off certainly feel it was worth the cost.
On to your favorite actress slash musician slash person in the world, Taylor Swift. She is clean. The copyright suit has been dismissed over lyrics to Shake It Off.
Yeah, last week a California federal judge dismissed a copyright lawsuit over one single phrase in her hit 2014 song, Shake It Off. The phrase, anyone know the phrase? You know the phrase, Sam. It's one of your favorite lines.
I don't.
Player's gonna play, hater's gonna hate.
Oh, yes.
That line.
It's tattooed on my biceps. I've got one on each bicep.
Yep. Sean Hall and Nathan Butler filed suit alleging that line was stolen by Taylor Swift from a song called Player's Gonna Play, or Player's Gun Play, which they wrote for another group in 2001. They filed suit. Taylor Swift fought it. And again, last week, Judge Michael Fitzgerald dismissed it after determining that, quote, combining two truisms about playas and haters, both well-worn notions as of 2001, is simply not enough to be eligible for protection under the Copyright Act. So, you know, notable for the decision, but also notable for maybe the only time that a federal judge has used the term playas and haters in a decision.
I love when you say haters gon' hate. It's it shows your true colors.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
The whitest
daughter
interpretation
of
those words ever.
You are so white. The daughter of Elvis Presley, Lisa Marie Presley, is suing her business manager. She's saying he ruined her finances. She whittled everything down, and she lost $16 million. $16 million in debt, Lisa Marie Presley.
Yeah, she had assets, according to the lawsuit, in excess of $100 million in her trust, much of that, you know, from her father's assets. And according to the lawsuit, her manager, Barry Siegel, whittled that $100 million fortune down to just $14,000. She accused her manager of dissipating her wealth through his, quote, reckless and negligent mismanagement and self-serving ambition. According to the complaint, he bought a home for himself, spent over $40 million on this other investment that didn't pan out. She is now $16.7 million in debt. She defaulted on the mortgage to her home. Now, the manager has fought back, predictably. Said that he, through his own lawsuit, said that Lisa Marie Presley has uncontrollable spending habits, said that she's going through a difficult time and she's looking to blame others. So, another example of a celebrity going through their, you know, fortune and, as we've seen in many cases, suing a manager or an agent for that.
And maybe the least surprising news of all time, the children of the stars of the Real Housewives TV show, they have found themselves in some trouble. I'm seeing some drunk driving charges, ecstasy and heroin possession, battery, shoplifting, resisting arrest, hit and run, possessing a weapon. Lots of charges against the children, the troubled children of the Real Housewives.
What's wrong with these kids? What's wrong with kids today? Especially the ones who are offshoots of such stable people like the Real Housewives. Yeah, we've got, do you know these people? Lynn Curtin, she's one of the housewives. Sam, you know her?
Yes.
Her daughter
was,
you do. Alexa, who is apparently an ex-adult film actress. She was arrested in 2016, charged with vandalism. She keyed her boyfriend's car. There is currently a warrant out on her arrest. We've got Victoria De Lesseps, who is was arrested at Christmas for drunk driving. Another son, this one is Josh Peterson. His mom is Lori Peterson from the Real Housewives of, do we know, Orange County?
New Jersey, probably. Oh, is it Orange County?
I don't know. He was arrested for ecstasy and heroin possession, battery, shoplifting, resisting arrest, hit and run, and attempted murder. We've got Bella Hadid, who's very notable. She is a supermodel. Her mother is Yolanda Hadid, and she was also arrested for DUI. That was back in 2014. And finally, Alexa Echeverria. She is a Real Housewife of Miami. Her son Peter was arrested for marijuana possession and for assaulting a homeless man. So, I don't know.
Wait, don't forget Nene Leakes.
Don't forget Nene Leakes' son, Bryson. Yeah.
What did he do?
Possession of a weapon by an inmate, then shoplifting razors.
Yeah, so, I mean, what's the story? Does the Real Housewives not pay enough? Is this a result of these kids growing up in celebrityhood and not having a, you know, a sense of values, or who knows?
How about the parents should be parents? I mean, these parents clearly care more about FaceTime and television time than they do about their damn kids.
Yeah, favorite housewife, go.
I don't have one. They all suck.
Greg Collins, favorite?
Well, my favorite
idea?
Season has to be New Jersey, but yeah. I don't know. I don't have a favorite wife.
All right. How do we not talk about favorite Tay-Tay song, favorite T-Swift song?
22.
We covered.
Mine's 22. 22.
Craig, any preferences?
Blank Spaces.
That's a good one. Yeah. I actually went to the Taylor Swift concert at Soldier Field a couple years ago during that tour. Pretty good. I was the only grown man there, though. My excuse was I was there with my teenage daughter. I had an excuse. There was no doubt.
This is why you had a daughter.
No, but listen, there was no joke. A guy behind me, about six rows behind me at Soldier Field, we were on the side of the stage. He had to have been about 28 or 29. This dude was standing the entire concert, like lip-syncing every word to every Taylor Swift song. And like also doing air guitar sometimes, inappropriate air guitar, you know, when there wasn't clearly any guitar happening. I just, you know, he's one of those guys at a concert that you see every time that you cannot take your eyes off
of. Was he completely alone or did he have at least one
friend? He was alone. He was just, yeah, he was rocking out to T-Swift.
But he did buy the two seats next to him. So he probably had some, he had wiggle room.
His friends were coming later. That's what he kept telling people.
They were getting beers. Yeah, they were getting beers the whole show. This is it. Child's Play 3, an actor from Child's Play 3, facing jail.
Yeah, we're really scraping the bottom of the legal celebrity news barrel when we're picking up the Child's Play 3 actor facing jail time. Yeah, he stole his mom's car. This is Jeremy Silvers, who's best known for playing Tyler in Child's Play 3.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
is right, facing right. Jail time for stealing his mother's car. He's 37 years old, six misdemeanor charges, including driving and taking a vehicle without consent, assault with a deadly weapon, which was a phone, and some other charges. He stole his mother's Honda CR-V. They took him into custody in L.A., and he was booked but not charged with felony grand theft auto. I guess the residuals from Child's Play 3 are not as strong as one would expect.
And he could face 3.5 years in prison if he's convicted on all six counts.
Yeah, is that real prison or is that like Chucky prison?
The deadly weapon wasn't the car, though? The deadly weapon
Yeah, I thought
was the
so,
phone?
And then it said a phone. How could a phone be a deadly weapon?
I have no idea.
Yeah, in the hands of Chucky, everything's a deadly weapon. How many Chuckies have there been? There's been at least seven, maybe?
There's been more Chuckies than Real Housewives, definitely.
That would be a good mashup, though. You know, Chucky dating one of the Real Housewives?
No? Do you know, there were exactly seven? How did you know that?
I mean, I'm a horror movie, you know,
got it.
Fiend. Colin DeGilia, he probably does not like Child's Play.
Favorite Chucky movie?
I like Bride of Chucky. Jennifer Tilly. Jennifer Tilly's in many of them. And then there's, you know, Seed of Chucky, which brings to mind the question of how do they procreate? How does the two Chucky dolls procreate enough to form the Seed of Chucky?
But you've seen last year's Cult of Chucky as well?
Saw that one. That was good. Yeah, I mean, Chucky just keeps going. It's been, what, 30 years almost.
Yeah, he looks great for his age. Chucky's aged really well, too.
Looks good. He's had some work done. yeah.
Is there anything I missed here on Legal Face Off? Anything I missed this week?
I think the only thing we missed is Tina Martini.
Yeah. Godspeed, Tina. Feel better, please.
Feel better and join us for the next Legal Face Off in couple of weeks.
Thanks to our guests Dan Capron, Jack Tice, Laura Wasser, and Treg Duerson for joining us. Anytime you missed anything, you can always go to WGMRadio.com. Look for Legal Face Off for Rich, Tina, Craig, and Sam. We'll talk to you next time on LFO.